Hello, and welcome to the Batters Included podcast. It's Friday, March 29, 2026, and this is episode 141. On today's show, we'll be talking about the launch of the Ferrari Luce, driving the new Chevy Bolt across the country, Walmart's monster charging network is taking shape, and of course, much, much more. I'm your host, Dominic Ioni. Joining us today is the insuperable Mr. Tom Malogny, host of the YouTube channel State of Charge and the premier EV charging news site, evchargingstations.com. Kyle Connor is with us today from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Autospec Studios, and Wes will join us very shortly for the very first time from the Autospec testing channel.
Grizzly. At Grizzly, we believe charging your electric vehicle should be simple, reliable, and affordable. That's why we design, engineer, and build our chargers in Canada, ensuring top-tier quality and performance. Powered by United Chargers, every Grizzly model is crafted in-house, built to withstand extreme conditions, and tested for reliability. Recognized by leading publications for its performance and value, Grizzly delivers both durability and intelligence with heavy-duty aluminum enclosures, premium output cables, and smart charging features like scheduling, usage tracking, and OCPP compatibility with multiple charging apps. Grizzly. Simple. Reliable. Affordable. Built for every climate, every EV, everywhere you go. Visit grizzly.com to learn more.
All right. So welcome to the show. Good to see you, Kyle and Tom. You guys have both been super busy traveling the last few weeks. So before we get into talking about driving America's cheapest EV across the country, I think we should talk about an EV that gets that will start somewhere around $640,000 when it becomes available in the U.S. around the second quarter of next year. But before we get into that, Kyle, we talked about Ellie's passing a couple weeks ago on the show, and we wanted to pass on our condolences. And we also like to share today that you have a new T-shirt that celebrates Ellie, with the proceeds going to the Shine On Project, run by the Golden Retriever Foundation of North America, which is researching the condition that led to Ellie's passing. And so I just wanted to, you know, just share this on here. I didn't mention this to you before the show or anything, but yeah, I thought it was a very cool shirt, and I love Be Like Ellie. It's a great, just a great way to celebrate her and raise money for research, you know.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Didn't know you were going to do that. Really appreciate it. And of course, yeah, thanks to everyone who's bought the shirts. We're just compiling up, you know, of course, once we reach a certain amount, I don't know how we'll do it. We'll just donate all of that to the Shine On Project and just keep that going until the shirt is sold out. So thank you, guys.
And $29 right. for like a custom shirt that's for a cause is really cheap. Usually, like when you do a shirt like this, Kyle, where it's like a donation, this t-shirts are like $40 or $50. So that's actually a really good deal. I mean, you'd pay that for a shirt regardless.
Yeah, we were kind of just thinking keep it the same price of all of our other merch, and hopefully just sell more of them and then just donate all of that over. So, you know, there was some discussion. Do we raise the price? Of course, because we're announcing the fund or cause or research organization it's going to, we figured if people wanted to donate more, they could just head over there and donate. Hey, Wes.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Wes.
We are recording right now. We're in the show, so you're on live.
We are live. Thanks for joining us, Wes. We invited you on because you've been doing some testing of the Chevy Bolt that they drove across the country, so we wanted to touch on that a little bit. But I thought maybe we could start off with you, though, telling us just a bit about yourself, how you got into EVs, and what you do on the testing channel.
Yeah, so I got into EVs probably 2018 or so. I had somebody at the time that I knew started talking about Tesla and different things, and I was like, oh, and then anyway, got into that, and one thing led to another, and then you're full into everything. And so, and then I started following Out of Spec probably 2019, and then got connected with Kyle and Scott, and that's led to doing some testing. So, you know, I've just had a pretty good base knowledge on EVs from following for so many years, and that's just led me right into the natural tendency to like the nerdy stats and all the things that Kyle has started up and done so much in Out of Spec. So yeah, it's been good.
Right on. So we're going to talk about the Chevy Bolt in a minute, which you did some tests on. But first we wanted to talk about something that's a bit more polarizing than that. Mm-hmm. So this is Kyle's favorite new car. It's called, so let me just set it up. In 2013, Ferrari chairman Luca di Montezemolo, say that fast five times, Montezemolo said, we will never manufacture an electric car as long as I'm chairman. Well, 13 years later, he is not chairman, and Ferrari has launched its first EV, a four-door, five-seater it calls Luce, which is Italian for light. Montezemolo, man, that's bad, doesn't run Ferrari anymore, but he's still around and has thoughts about this EV. We risk destroying his legend, he said on Tuesday, arguing that the car does not deserve to display the Ferrari prancing horse badge. The only silver lining he offered, well, at least he says this is definitely a car the Chinese won't imitate. So there's your silver lining for the Luce from the former director. So that reaction, the reaction from practically everyone else, you know, capable of voicing an opinion, I believe is similar. I think one of our regular viewers had one of the best I read. I'm really quite surprised that the Luce makes the Daytona Charger look like a great EV, which, you know, the Daytona Charger is like from Dodge, and it's, you know, famously not gotten good reviews. And Kyle, you've driven it, and was not your favorite. It had a huge lag in the software, but yeah. So I'm looking forward to hearing your reactions. But first, I guess I should give you some quick specs. The Luce, it sits on a bespoke platform. It has an 800-volt architecture and a 122-kilowatt-hour battery made with cells from SK. Those cells have a 305 watt-hour per kilogram energy density, which is kind of remarkable, worth noting. And I'll just start. We're playing this clip in the showing you the car in the other window here. So peak charging is 350 kilowatts. Ferrari says it's possible to recharge 70 kilowatt hours in 20 minutes. So you might assume like a 10 to 80 charge is probably around 25 minutes. Range is 329 WLTP miles, so maybe 300 miles EPA. It has four electric motors, one for each wheel, which together can produce 830 kilowatts or 1,113 horsepower. Little fun fact, the front motors can spin up to 30,000 RPM, which only the Yangwon U9 track edition, the Extreme, that's the only thing that matches that speed. 0 to 62 happens in 2.5 seconds, 0 to 125 mile an hour in 6.8 seconds. So that's kind of the basics. So Wes, this is a pretty high-end kind of car. I'm not sure if you've tested anything quite at this level yet, but why don't you start us off and just give us your overall impressions of the Luce.
Do we know the weight on this yet?
It is, all I know is that it's 400 pounds lighter than the Mercedes-AMG four-door coupe that we talked about last week.
I don't know if that's
so it's like, no, it's like close to around 5,000, 4,800, 5,000, I'm thinking.
Yeah, that might be pretty typical for those. But yeah, this was, it's interesting to me because it feels almost inevitable that some of these companies are going to jump on the big, you know, GT car, over 1,000 horsepower, kind of that Porsche Taycan Model S class. But it just, at least for me, the design, and I think everybody else on the internet, it's not there. I don't know. It doesn't follow the design language of Ferrari. It doesn't feel authentic to Ferrari. It doesn't make sense to me. it feels like this is a okay kind of everybody's going this direction. We need to just make our own thing and throw it up there, rather than, I feel like, just from my experience of viewing it, like a company like Koenigsegg has, every car they come out is just so intentional and it fits their brand so well compared to whatever this is. Just, I don't know. That, and I think, price wise, it's kind of insane. I feel like for what this is not going to make sense in the price in the market. And I don't think many people like the design.
That's fair. I mean, that's kind of what a lot of people are saying, right?
Yeah.
Not sure. I was thinking like the positive negative comments are running like 1 to 99, basically. Like 1 in 100, you know, has something positive to say about it. Tom, you have some Luce thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, how do you not? So the interesting thing is, I actually like the design. But I have to qualify that, not for Ferrari. You know, if this came out, and other people have said this online too, I've seen, if this came out under a completely different brand, and it was a Taycan, Lucid Air Sapphire type competitor, $125,000, $150,000, I think everyone would be looking at it in a completely different light. I know I would. I mean, I don't think it's like, but ugly, like I've heard people describe it at all. I just think it's strayed so far from what we expect a Ferrari to be that we can't digest that. We can't accept that. You know, when people, if you remember when the Mustang Mach-E came out, there was a similar type of, uproar from the Mustang enthusiasts that, you know, that thing is not a Mustang, you know, it'll never be, and there'll never be an electric Mustang. And it doesn't follow Mustang's design language. It's four doors. How could a Mustang have four doors? You know, we heard all this kind of similar type of, outrage when the Mustang came out. I just Wes mentioned that it doesn't, follow any design language that Ferrari uses. And I think that's what people expect. You know, when someone spends $600,000 on a car and it drives quickly down the road, that the owner generally wants people to know, I just bought a Ferrari. And you wouldn't know that with this. You know, it'd be like, well, that's kind of some kind of weird new modern thing. But nothing about it says Ferrari. And I think that's part of owning a Ferrari, that it's so, indistinguishable that, like, there's no question, that that's a Ferrari when it comes rolling down the road. As far as the vehicle itself, I don't know. I don't think a lot of people know. There's been no driving reports on it yet, how well of a job they did, designing it. How will this thing do on the ring? It seems like there's a tremendous amount of tech in it, but at $600,000, this to me is not a $600,000 looker. That's part of the price tag. When you buy something that's, $750,000 practically, you want it to look like that. And I think this looks more like a $150,000 high end type of a futuristic car. So that's where they missed the mark for me. I mean, I'd buy a 3 year old one of these for $65,000 in a minute, but that's not going to happen. So that's my two cents on it.
Kyle, is that going to happen?
It's hard to predict the future. I don't see how it couldn't happen.
$65,000. I mean, Ferraris usually go up in value, don't they, as they age?
Or not recently.
Or is that not the case anymore? Oh, okay.
Not the recent ones. Some.
Right. Right. So this is the second one they've made with four doors. They just did the Ferrari Purosangue, which was, more of a crossover kind of thing. Very also not a traditional type of Ferrari. And I guess I got some amount of backlash for that, but not too bad. This, I've never seen Ferrari mentioned in so much like over the past few days. I mean, if what they say about, no press being bad press or whatever, I mean, I think they're off to a great start because, I mean, Ferrari has been in everybody's mouth, right? So, but you are also not impressed with this at all, right?
Well, I never said that. I just said I quit. That's all I said. I don't want to work anymore. I don't want to be in a world where this exists. I quit everything.
I mean, that sounds like a negative sign of sentiment.
It might be the most technically impressive car. It might be. I don't know.
Right.
Because Ferrari,
okay.
You look at it and you go, well, I don't care if this thing's made and powered by unicorn farts. It could be amazing. I have no interest in that. I am not a Ferrari purist, by the way. I just am someone who have driven many Ferraris. I do think they're some of the most amazing driving cars. But the company is so stuck up. Listening to Shmi 150's Tim Burton's process on what he had to go through to film the car and the controlled nature of how Ferrari did that meant that all of the, like, they really did automotive journalists or media a real disservice by trying to control the experience as much as possible and not getting the actual facts come out. So not only is the car ugly, Ferrari made media look poor in bad taste, tried to control the message so much. And there's so many media in our world that are so concerned about keeping automakers happy that they couldn't even formulate their own thoughts. They just had to be positive about it. And I mean, I know some of these people in retrospect, they're like, yeah, this thing is a pile of garbage from a design perspective. Look at the windshield wipers. They stand up the windshield. This is the dumbest thing on the planet. Who cares about airflow in your car? And by the way, they still do this, and it's 300 miles of EPA range, under 300 miles of EPA range. So I thought it was disrespectful to the media. I thought the car is disrespectful to enthusiasts. I thought the car is completely out of the realm of what Ferrari has done, which they keep saying, but they should not have done it this way. They should have done something really exciting. If they were going to do an electric car like this, it should have been a $195,000 electric car that's positioned as the daily driver for the Ferrari collector. Don't make this a $640,000 base, $750,000 by the time you get some options on it, a $750,000 car to then make that a daily driver. No one's going to go for that. Even Ferrari collectors are saying, hell no. So that's the design. That's the communication strategy. That's the company being completely over controlling. And that deserves all of the disrespect in the world. What does deserve some respect, at least off the initial look, is the tuning, the calibration, the electric motor, the thermal management, the stability control systems with new generations of ESP and really cool wheel speed control logic, like really getting up there with some really interesting things. So look, when a car launches like this, it's easy to just blanket it as that's dumb. And this is, and it is easy to blanket that way because it's Ferrari making this weird Apple car. If this came from Acura, if this came from Toyota or someone, we would all be losing our minds. We would be like, this is the coolest freaking thing ever. It's the Ferrari badge. It's the wrong company building a really cool product. And so I can't wait to drive it and experience it. I'm sure it's going to be amazing from some of the folks I've talked to that were involved with the project. It sounds like it's just a magical masterpiece. And I don't know. We haven't seen the driving reviews yet. I know some media have already had the chance to drive it. Marquez mentioned he drove it. But it's the wrong brand building this car, and it's the complete wrong price point. This is astronomically way too expensive, even for the Ferrari collector. And so I think we're going to see a lot of hatred, a lot of people being made fun of these. No one wants to drop $750,000 and get made fun of on the street. I think we're going to see them in the, close to $100,000 range in not too distant future. And if that's the case, then maybe it does make sense. And you just take the Ferrari badge off, put an Apple badge on, and you're good to go. Interior switchgear looks amazing. The drivetrain stuff looks amazing. Battery pack looks amazing. How did it get such a poor range score? I have no idea. That's worth digging into. But at the end of the day, this is the dumbest car of the year.
Right. I don't really mind the design. At first, I was like, it should be an Apple car, right? Like it was designed by Johnny Ive, famously from Apple, with his partner who designed a Ford back in the day. Was it 01412C, something like that? It has a front end that kind of looks like this back end. It's got the circular sort of thing, but this back end It looks like there's the actual Ferrari is like parked inside the car, basically, you know? It's like, maybe it doesn't look like that in person.
I saw a quote online, and I wish I could give the credit where it's due, but Ferrari needs a cease and desist from itself. Like, this should not have happened.
Right. But yeah, but watching that same video, I watched the Marquez video, and, you know, he did drive it, and he said he couldn't give drive an impression yet. But I could tell, like, I could see the gears in his mind thinking back about driving it, and I think he had an incredible experience.
I'm sure he did. But here's the thing: is it going to hold up? So, like, you can get in most cars these days, and I'm not accusing Marquez of this, but most people could get into right. Let's just choose a normal performance car, a Toyota Supra. It's like 60 grand. I don't know, something like that, right? And you could throw them in the passenger seat, and I could make that car do stuff that would blow that person's mind. They'd be, wow, I had no idea a car could ever do that. That's a Toyota Supra. So you need someone who's totally comfortable with 911 Turbo S's, boring. Taycan Turbo GTs, boring. Sapphire, boring. Like, you are totally good with the car. You understand the powertrain management. You know what the vehicle's doing from a performance standpoint. You have to be so comfortable with that car and the control logic behind it on the limit to even begin to review something like this in a environment. And I'm not sure they had the time to really, and maybe they did, go through extreme levels of vehicle dynamics qualifications. Then the question becomes, okay, is the typical owner of a Luce going to drive their car in that way whatsoever? Many racetracks don't have DC fast charging equipped at them. Many people who buy this car will have, you know, an SF90XX for the weekends, for the track days. This is going to be their daily driver. Electric is perfect for performance demonstrations and daily drivers. It is not perfect for weekend track days or enthusiast mountain driving, because you're just worried about charging all the time. Anyone that can afford this will drive their combustion Ferrari. So then it should have just been a $200,000 electric daily driver luxury car, essentially what it will depreciate down to. And all of those performance engineering stuff, the magic sauce they probably sprinkled in this, will be completely wasted.
Right. I get your point about the price tag, but I also think, man, because they insist on making everything themselves, so they have this like forever Ferrari kind of program where they can work on Ferraris from whenever. And so they did insist on making like the motors and doing the batteries themselves, everything. So, and the programming, all that, you know, takes a, they bust a, I don't know how much money they put into this thing, like developing it, but I'm sure it's a lot. And they can use some of that will roll forward into next electric products down the road. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, you know, Ferrari owners, do they care how much it costs? You know?
Yeah. I mean, when you start talking $750,000, people care. If you were talking the difference between 200 and 250 or 300, right. Sure. People would just buy it because it would get them the allocation for the next big car to come, especially in the US market. That's a real big thing.
True. That's the thing about Ferrari buying that a lot of people might not be aware of. You know, to buy the nice Ferrari, you have to be an established customer of Ferrari already. You can't just run in and buy like the $2 million Ferrari. You have to buy some cheaper ones first.
Yeah, you're awarded the opportunity to buy the good stuff only after you buy all the bad stuff. And not to say that any of their cars are bad, but just the undesirable cars might be the better way to say it. Ferrari claims that won't be the case with the Luce. They said they're going to have some scheme where it isn't going to happen. But I'm going to tell you right now, if it's sold through Ferrari dealers in the US and they've got five of them sitting on the dealership lot, if you say, hey, I'm going to take all five Luces off your lot, you can buy whatever Ferrari you want after that. So there, that game will happen.
Yeah. Oh, I'm kind of hoping I understand people don't like the styling of it. I don't really mind it so much. I'm not a big fan of the back, but I'm really impressed by like the interior and the switchgear, the calibration, like you say. And I don't really understand all the magic that they've done for those stability controls and things, but it looks like it should be pretty impressive. This is the first car with four, you know, with a motor on each wheel, but also with rear steer. So there's like hardly any kind of room for friction in turns, right? The wheel's working with you. They're going to proper speeds.
Is it the first quad motor vehicle with rear steer? Is that what they're saying?
I'm saying that. Maybe I'm. Am I forgetting something?
Well, there's Chinese dude crazy.
Hummer's got three wheels, three motors.
Yeah.
Remax got four motors, but no rear steer.
I mean, maybe. Don't know. It just comes down to the
Yang Wang.
And here's the thing. Ferraris are always tuned light and agile, and I'm not questioning the fact that it's very likely that this car will drive incredible. But, you know, and we have to shoot a comparison test at some point, but, like, getting a Sapphire today for $250 or a Taycan Turbo GT for $250, and it will blow anyone's mind, and the car's capability is typically way above the driver. So you're really just targeting a Ferrari-minded customer here with this car. And the Ferrari people don't like it. So I'm not sure who it's for. It's maybe for a new tech bro, right? But tech bros are driving full self-driving these days. So it's completely confusing to me.
Yeah. I haven't seen any like actual Ferrari customers like make any... I guess I could have gone over... There's a Ferrari forum I know I'm familiar with. I should have gone over there. I just thought about that now.
Well, there's a collector named David Lee who did some content around it. And he played it pretty PG. You could tell he didn't want to piss off Ferrari. And that is the unfortunate reality of the Ferrari world, is media and customers are afraid to speak their mind because they want the next allocation.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that comes out the second quarter of next year. So I guess we'll see what happens with that. And, you know, If it went down to $100,000, would you pick one up? If you heard, if the experience was said to be, you know, just as amazing as it could possibly be.
Yeah, if they depreciate, I could see that being my daily driver. Absolutely. I would just take the Ferrari badge off, slap an Apple badge on there, and call it a day. If you take the whole Ferrari-ness out, it's not that bad. It's just the fact that a company that everyone associates with high-performance, emotional, desirable cars is producing an incredibly undesirable, unemotional vehicle. That's just so lame.
Okay, well, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. So, but we'll leave that for now. And see, let's talk about something else. So last week, Kyle, you were the first person to drive the new Chevy Bolt across the country, probably. But for sure, you were the first to drive across the country using only Iona charging. And you live streamed the whole thing on Out of Spec Motoring. So there's hours and hours people can tune in and go over to Out of Spec Motoring and you know, watch it unfold in real time, practically. So many hours. Like we have like five episodes, like 9-10 hours long.
I don't know. No, I just live-streamed. Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty great. And so it wasn't a race. And I understand that you met up with fans of the channels at some of the charging stops. So whose crazy idea was this? And like, how did it go? Like the Iona network is pretty amazing for being so young, but there must have been some challenging stretches.
I'm happy to chat about the trip. Maybe we should talk in chronological order of our time with the Bolt just before we get into the trip. Since Wes is here, he can run us through how it did with testing. Because Wes really drove it for about a week before I ever even stepped in the vehicle. So, Wes, maybe you could talk a little bit about the Bolt. And, Dominic, I don't want to forget on this show also to talk about what I'm sitting in right now.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's coming up. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so honestly, we ran the Bolt through most all of our testing, and it's pretty good. I'd say so for those of you who don't know, I came from a 2017 and a 2020 Bolt actually, and put probably 60,000 miles between those two cars. And I think they fixed a lot of the things they needed to fix, and one of the biggest things would be, of course, the fast charging. I mean, everybody knows they've very slow DC fast charging, 50 kilowatts, and then a lot less than that once you get over 40-something%. But yeah, it did, I would say, really well in our 10% challenge. totally competitive with any other crossover in that category. And then we did, I think a range test was decent, not the best in the world, but perfectly reasonable for what this car needs to do and the price and where it's at.
Just tell us real quick how the 10% challenge works, just for new viewers.
Oh, yeah. So 10% challenge, basically we start at 10% at a charger. So we drive it down to 10%. As soon as it hits 10%, we'll charge it for exactly 15 minutes. And then we see how far we can go at 80 miles an hour on the highway. And that gives us a score or a number in mileage where we can go, okay, this is really good, this is bad, this is pretty good. And that usually ranges anywhere between like 70 and 150 plus miles, depending on the car. But 70 to 100 is still considered really good or solid road tripper. And this did a pretty good score right in between there. So it was... Yeah.
And okay. I guess we'll see if, as far as road tripping, you know, how it does it like in the real world too. But so range test, how was it compared like to the previous one?
So I had learned a little after I had started testing this, that this was based on the Bolt EUV platform from just a couple of years ago and not the original Bolt. It's really kind of hard to tell because the way I've always can tell is the hood on the EUV is a little taller, like an SUV, but this one almost feels like it's in the middle between the original, but either way, so it was a little confusing, but yes, it is built on a slightly bigger platform, a little longer, a little more legroom in the back. So that's more of the comparison to put it against, but it, yeah, it did pretty well, but I would say but it has a little more battery capacity. So we found out this does like a lot of their, Ultium cars have actually pulls out more energy than what they claim on the sticker at 65. So it did, I would say, maybe competitive to the original Bolt because of a little bit of efficiency gain they've had in the new motors and systems they've put in there, but not really a huge gain in any way, I would say, because it's a little heavier and things, it's bigger, it's kind of washed out, and the better efficiency has just kind of canceled out with the size difference and stuff. But yeah, it's quite comparable in that. It's just the charging is the big thing that was a problem that they've made a huge leap on, and that clearly has made a difference, as we can see.
So we're looking
with Ayana too,
right? So we're looking at this chart on your video here of the range test at 222 miles. That was your final result?
Yeah, that's what I got with that one. It was, yeah, see, that was a pretty mild day, not too windy, not too hot or cold, but yeah, it's that, I think what is EPA is around 260, if I'm not wrong on that, somewhere around there, but it's I would have hoped to see it do a little better than that, but in my experience with Bolts, the highway efficiency is not the best in the world. And so maybe because it's a little boxy hatchback, it just doesn't do the best. But I would say that's pretty much what I would have gotten on an old Bolt with the 65 kilowatt hour battery, at least. But again, that just the efficiency or the size difference kind of washes out. And that's where you get, yeah, pretty good.
Right on. Those are the two tests that you... I'm just looking in the channel. Yeah, okay. So you did, those are the two tests, but just driving it yourself. So you're familiar. You've had Bolts before. So generally, just driving it as a consumer, what'd you think?
Yeah. So it does have the Bolt feel. So I have I've had the ability to drive. My dad has a Chevy Equinox, like a 2025, and it does have a totally different feel to that car. They're just very different vehicles in the way that they drive and feel, but it still has that dartiness and kind of a little bit of fun. It's a little softer, probably because it's on the EUV platform than the old Bolt, but it is more comfortable on the highway, which is nice because there are some problems with that, with the old Bolt being a little bouncy. But the dynamics feel very similar and just kind of a happy little car. It's still fun.
We shouldn't forget Tom's also done testing on the new Bolt. So how the held up between them?
Yeah. So and I'm a current 2023 Bolt owner and an Equinox owner. So I a lot of experience in those three, all completely different personalities, in my opinion. I do have the front-wheel drive Equinox, which is a little underpowered for that size and weight of a vehicle. So it's really not as torquey as you would expect from a normal or another electric. It's probably the slowest electric vehicle I've ever really owned. Well, it is the slowest. The 2023 Bolt is a blast to drive. It's got a tremendous amount of torque. It's small. It's light. It's great, like darting through traffic. I don't get that as much with the new 2027. It's a lot less torque. I forget the numbers, but I don't know. It's like 50 or 60 pound feet less torque. I forget what it is. And you can absolutely feel it. When you get up to around 40 miles an hour, I think there feels very similar to the previous version Bolts. But that getting up to 40, it's not slow by any means. I mean, it's got more punch than the Equinox for sure. But the original Bolt was like, it was really a blast to drive, or it is a blast to drive. You know, I remember when we did the original Bolt first drive, they actually set up like a course, a rally course in a parking lot. And when we got there, I was kind of like, why would they do this for this little economy car? And I know it's got, you know, it's got a lot of power, but like, it's going to be sloppy. Like there's no way this front wheel drive, we're going to be, you know, crashing into cones and everything. But then it turned out to actually rip pretty well for a little car. So, you know, the 2027 doesn't really have that same feel, in my opinion. It doesn't need to, though. You know, it's not, the car's not meant to be a weekend, you know, rally car. And it's got more than enough power. Specifically, if someone's coming from a combustion little compact car into the Bolt, they're going to be like, holy cow, this thing is powerful. Like, I think only the people that might feel it's underpowered are the people coming from the previous version Bolt. Bolt, you know what I mean? Because that had so much more kick. So, yeah, I think it's fine. I agree with Wes. It's got a little bit of a softer ride. I think it's more compliant. It might feel a little less econo box than the original Bolt when you're cruising on the highway going over road irregularities, potholes, and things like that. I think it felt a little bit just a little bit more compliant. So yeah, and charging wise, it's in a different stratosphere than the original Bolt. It's still not like the greatest charging electric vehicle there is. I mean, but what do you want for 30 grand? I just love the fact that Kyle posted on X that, and his quotes were that the new Bolt charges too fast. Now he followed that with to go get a bite to eat after, you know, while you're charging, but still I can cut that off. And, you know, Kyle actually said the new Bolt charges too fast, which I loved, but it charges fast enough for sure. You know, 25 minutes, 10 to 80. Can't complain about that for a car that costs 30 grand at all and goes to over 200 miles at highway speeds. I was supposed to do a 70 mile an hour highway range test last week. I had a Bolt on loan for 2 weeks actually from GM, and it had a problem, and it's actually a common problem with the Bolts. With the new Bolts now, GM's ironing it out. There's some sort of a false sensor that is telling the vehicle that the charge lock isn't actuating. So the NACS connector, the little pin that comes up to hold the NACS connector in, the vehicle thinks it's not engaging, but it is engaging. So day one, I get it. I drive it down to zero. I'm halfway through a 0-100% charging session at 50% state of charge, and the thing just shuts off. And it says, charge lock actuator malfunction. So I'm like, all right, this is great. Just wasted a whole day. So I take it home to charge it up to 100% or to charge it up a little bit more just to do some more driving. And it throws that same fault on my Tesla universal wall connector. So I'm like, this is interesting. So then I take out I plug in a regular J1772 charger and use the Chevrolet adapter, which Electron makes, and plugged it in and threw the fault again. So I'm like, okay, now let's just try everything. So I get my Ford Pro Charger and use the NACS to CCS to NACS AC adapter made by A to Z, which is a rare item. And you would only need to buy those if you have either the Ford Charger CCS with the CCS connector or the GM power shift charger that also has a CCS connector, but it's an AC charger. Those are rare birds. So I did that through the fault again. So I'm like, okay, it's the car. No matter what you do, the car does not want to continue charging. So when I contacted GM, they're like, yeah, we need to come pick this up right now. That's a terrible experience for you. All you want to do is charge the goddamn thing, and that doesn't work. So they came and picked it up, and I still don't have it back yet. But then I checked the message boards, and a lot of people are reporting this issue that are saying that. So it's a known problem on the Bolt. I am sure General Motors did whatever upgrade or fix before they gave Kyle his, knowing he's going to drive across the country with it. I'm disappointed in them that they didn't make sure the one they gave me in the press pool didn't already have that, because they know it's an issue and they know I'm going to charge it like 20 times in 2 weeks. So in any event, that's a current issue with the Bolt. There's nothing wrong with it. It's latching just fine, but the car thinks it's not latching properly.
Interesting. So, Kyle, no problems with this on your car across the country?
No, we've had zero, and I mean genuinely zero problems on our trip across the country. Getting to the start line, we had some problems because we happened to be road tripping right at a time when the Tesla supercharger network had a glitch. And we couldn't get it to supercharge. we finally did get it supercharging. But at our first stop, we had to go, and we were SOL. And it wasn't just us. It was everyone around, at least seemed a large percentage of people in the U.S., North America, and Europe were having the same bug we were running into. So we got that all sorted. And then we used Ayana the whole way across the country, and that really worked wonderfully. And I mean genuinely zero faults. The only fault that we had was my credit card triggered fraud warning because I had been traveling, I assume, so much. Once I cleared that, we were back up and good to go. So plug and charge worked wonderfully at Ayana. It just, the car worked wonderfully. Everything worked. Everything was easy. And it was a really fun trip. We met with a lot of people. So if you happen to be one of the folks who met up with us at an Ayana station or anywhere in between, great to see you guys. Thanks for everyone that helped us with drafting, especially as we got out west. The Ayana network is still pretty thin and needs some build out. But we, you know, pulled out all the tricks in the hat to accomplish our goal and went real slow and did the longest stretch was 344 miles in a snowstorm over the entire Rocky Mountain range. And we made it with 8% remaining. It was really no problem. I mean, you can get as much range as you need out of a car.
Yeah, Kyle, what was your like average speed on that leg? I didn't get to say it.
Slow, 40 maybe.
I mean, I was going to say 30 or 40 because there's no way you could have been going much 50.
At the end, I think we cruised in at 55. Once we're like,
well, you knew you were going to make it. Yeah,
way too much. Yeah. But at the beginning,
you're going downhill.
At the beginning, we took it way gentle. We were getting 7 miles per kilowatt hour for like a good hour.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I mean, that's amazing. You know, you and I have said this more than 100 times each, probably in our videos. You know, the best thing you could do is just slow down. If you think you're not going to make your destination with an electric car, and people say, oh, well, I'll be run off the road. You don't know where I live. You know, tractor trust. No, they won't. You park it in the slow lane. And you just go slow. You're not going to get rear-ended. You know, that's such a ridiculous fear that people worry about. You could park it and go slow. If you're really worried about it, put your hazards on. They're not going to use any energy, the LED flashes or whatever. But if you just slow down, you don't understand how much further you can make. Kyle just pointed it out here. You know, Wes just talked about doing a 70 mile an hour highway range test with a Bolt, and he went 222 miles. Kyle just took one and went 340 miles, Kyle, and had 8% battery left. He could have went 375 miles. You know, he could have went 150 miles farther than Wes was able to go at 70 miles an hour. Think about that. just slow it down.
In way worse conditions. It was 30 degrees outside. Well, there's a portion as we're cresting the tunnel. I'm literally just driving in snow and slush.
Yeah.
And it works. I mean, that's the thing. That is why mixed drive cycle range tests do not make sense to me. You should have a highway 70 mile per hour constant speed, or it could be 80, it could be 60, it could be whatever. The whole point of that is not to judge the range of your car, but it is to judge the difference in ranges across multiple vehicles in one set drive cycle. All of those vehicles can have their range extended at 50 miles an hour. By how much actually is another different metric, because if it's a huge battery car that doesn't really care so much about aerodynamic benefits, maybe it's not as big of a deal as if it's a little thing at 70. So your percentage of differences will change. But the reason Tom and I chose 70 mile per hour is that that's kind of a speed you just drive on average across our viewership basis, whether it's in Europe at 112 kilometers an hour is reasonable speed, or here in the US, you can pretty much go 70 wherever. You know, out west, it's going to be a bit higher. You know, out east, it's going to be a little bit lower. And you have a rough idea of what your car will do. Clearly, and this proves it, you can make your car go however far you need it to go. And, we did this for fun. There was not a 300 plus mile stretch without charging. We were committed to only using Ayana on this stretch. And we had 500, 1,000 people live streaming with us the whole way, encouraging us for this silly goal for no particular reason other than I was like, Ayana's got 110, 115 stations. Let's go see if we can go across the country. If we did it in a Lucid Air, everyone would have said, yeah, of course you could do it in a Lucid Air. You could charge two times and get across the country. We wanted to do it in the cheapest new electric car on sale. And that's why I called up Chevy. I'm like, we need a Bolt and it's going to get 3,500 miles put on it and we'll leave it in California. And they were like, hell yeah, let's do it.
And Kyle talked about it being the cheapest EV in America. That's not the only part. It's one of the shortest range new electric cars you can buy. At 262 miles EPA, there's not many new cars that have less EPA range. So Kyle's able to drive across country on a specific network, not charging anywhere, and do it. So that just goes to show you, most people that drive across country, they're not going to just stick to a specific network, any port in a storm. So you know how much easier it would be if he decided, I'm going to just charge anywhere, at Supercharger, at Electro America, wherever, it would have been no problem. He was able to take the youngest network that has the least amount of actual locations and just use those on the shortest range, one of the shortest range electric vehicles there are, and still do it. So the whole cross-country drive thing is like, we don't need to do this anymore, because Kyle just did it in the worst conditions and did it. So, okay, any car can do this.
Yeah, now we got to get more exciting. We got to go like Tierra del Fuego to Prudhoe Bay. And I think it's like 26,000 miles straight through.
Oof. Yeah. that's a trip. That'd be awesome.
Actually, the Pan American Highway
is... It's like 26,000, 26,600.
It's 19,000.
Is it?
Yeah, I thought it was in the 20s.
I do too. I should know better.
18,640 miles.
Oof. There are some British kids from, I believe, Oxford, one of the British universities, who did that trip in a converted Radical. Do you know the Radical from South America, the sports car? They converted one of those, like, I think 2010 or 2012, something way back in the day. They did the Pan American Highway somehow.
It's a life goal to be able to achieve that drive. Whether or not I want to do it electric is a different story, but I'd love to do the drive.
Right. And so you spent, several days in the Chevy Bolt and have probably as good an idea as anyone. What is, just to live with as a daily driver? So what do you think, like working with software, what do you think, like for the price, is it an amazing value or just okay?
It's completely frictionless. You charge it up to 100%. It's LFP. It's got plug and charge on Ayana, plug and charge with superchargers coming very soon, not available yet. It's a reasonably fine riding car. I mean, I can complain all day about nitpick that I think the rear needs a little bit more damping and, you know, blah, who gives a crap? It's a Bolt. It just, it drives, it works, it functions. It's a nice vehicle. And overall, like, I can't, like, it's the car I'm going to be recommending to most people because it's all the car most people need. Not only is it the cheapest new EV on sale in America, they have like $3,000, $5,000, $6,000 cash on the hood of these things right now. You can get a discount on a new Bolt. And that seems like I heard someone take delivery of one with Super Cruise for like $25,000, $26,000.
Not New Jersey, Kyle.
Well, you gotta go somewhere else.
I've called every dealership to get the best deal that there is in the area, and no one wants to budge off MSRP.
Really? You gotta travel. You gotta travel. Because there are consistently hearing $5,000-$6,000 plus Costco membership on these things, and that will change and ebb and flow. And yes, it is regional. But at the end of the day, like for mid $20,000 on a base spec, let's just say, you can't beat that. It's amazing. You know, is the software as good as Tesla? No. Does it have, is Super Cruise, which is optional, is that even nearly as close to FSD? No. But if you're just looking for a basic, nice, new, reliable daily driver, I mean, it was very reliable for us at least. I can't imagine a car that I would recommend more than the Bolt. It should just be like, okay, Bolt, then like base model 3, and then like maybe step up into a Y with FSD if you need like a really nice stuff. Those are like the cars I'm recommending the most to people right now because they just work, they're reliable, and they're relatively nice.
So Chevy Bolt over the Nissan Leaf? The new Nissan Leaf?
100 million times over the Leaf.
Okay. What is it? Like, what are the top? Right.
But like the Leaf, you have to option battery preconditioning. And the Leaf, you have like in the base model, you don't even get like route planning unless you get the top spec. Like they really try to decontent the base model from the stuff that matters. And with the Bolt, you get LFP, you get everything you need out of the car included in the standard one. The way to go is actually to get a standard Bolt. And one thing we didn't mention, which was really cool, Andreas and I were driving on the live stream, and we noticed a comment from someone who said, hey, I work at General Motors. Looks like you're going to be driving past the factory where we build the Bolt. Do you want to stop in? And we were just a few hours away from the factory. And we stayed overnight. We stopped the trip a little bit early, stayed overnight, and went first thing in the morning, 6:30 a.m., and toured the whole production line of the Bolt. We have a whole video on our reviews channel with Robert from Aging Wheels doing that. It was so fun. It was so impromptu. And, you know, this is just a limited run car. So I hope they continue building them. It's potential, the possibility that they could continue this on the line in a, you know, potentially mixing in other models. It's not confirmed, but, I just thought it was just a fun trip, and we haven't done one of those in a while. Everything we've been doing has been races, comparison, this versus that. It was just nice that Andreas and I, my buddy, we just went on a road trip and we met people and there was no agenda and it was great.
Right on. Yeah, I enjoyed your factory tour. That was great. Great video. And it's good to see Robert on screen again. He's put out a great video last week. He's got that Lordstown pickup truck. So if you want to watch a great video, Aging Wheels channel about the Lordstown truck with the in-wheel motors. He did a great job of that. He's so good at this.
I think it's peak YouTube. Yeah. I think Robert's Lordstown video is YouTube is only downhill from here. That is just the best video of the year and maybe even of all time.
Wow. It was pretty fun. Yeah. Driving the Bolt across the country wasn't enough live streaming for 1 week. So you also bought a car and then road trip for 700 miles or so. Just really quickly, because we don't have a ton of time left, but yeah, there's still a few things we need to talk about. Tell us about what you got.
Model S production run ended. We all know that, which is the car this podcast probably wouldn't exist without the Model S. It's just such a transformative car. We would all agree. And if you're a viewer and don't agree, you're wrong. That car changed the world. It's incredible. Yeah. You could agree to like or dislike it in the current marketplace. I thought it was the worst out of its competitors. And I own a modern one. I have a plaid version of a relatively recent example. And still, I would admit today, a Lucid and a Taycan drive way better. But it's hard to emphasize how pivotal that car was and everything that car stood for and helped, you know, Tesla engineer their future products like that Model Y you're looking at on screen. And I thought it'd be pretty cool to own one of the first ever produced Model S's. So on our Bolt live stream, we were just chatting about that. And a guy pops in the chat and says, hey, I own a Model S Signature. I'm like, well, that's really cool. And the Signature was not actually the very first run. There was a small batch of Founders Series Model S's.
True.
About 20 or 40 of them. They're pretty rare. They are out there. Some of our viewers do own them. I think I saw 4 or 5 comments from people who have them that are current viewers. So maybe we'll get one of those one day. But the Signature is the bookends, more or less, of the run, because they ended it on the Signature and they started it with the Signature. And this is Signature 182 that you're looking at right here. And it's my Signature 182. And I bought it. It had just under 100,000 miles on it. We bought it on the live stream, did the live negotiation. And we drove up to Michigan and drove it back. It's amazing that the Model Y in side-by-side conditions was about 30-ish percent more efficient than the Model S. I mean, it just shows that an SUV getting so much more efficient through those little iterative changes from the old school days. But on the flip side, this car still has dog mode, and it's been upgraded with MCU2, and it's still supported by Tesla. And it was actually on newer software than our Model Y, believe it or not. So it really is pretty incredible how well Tesla has supported their vehicles, except for the Roadster. They've done a very bad job, I think, supporting Roadster owners up until maybe very recently. And with all that said, we've got a car that we park in front of the office, and we'll pull it out for some commemorative stories from time to time.
Right on. So you wanted me to ask you about what you're sitting in right now. So I thought I'd do that. So this, I want to talk about this more once you've had a chance to run it through some testing and experience it just a bit more. But not too long ago, you had the Lightship AE1 on loan for a little while and did a lot of testing with that. So now you have its main competitor, I think. Maybe there's something else out there, I don't know. But in my mind, the Pebble Flow, I think, right, is it's like the main kind of competitor to the Lightship.
There's
and
also
so you just
Evo, right? Correct, I believe, and Aboard is the last one of like the four core group of these things.
Okay, so this one showed up with the founder of the company brought it by for you.
Yep, the founder came by and gave us a full presentation. He and I shot a 2-hour video walking through how to use everything. I've now stayed in it for a night. We've towed with it. I'm in it right now for the viewers who are looking at home. I'm in the Pebble. I'm actually at the farm, and I can show you that. Oh, you guys will love this. Let me just show you a cool little trick on this thing. Okay.
Sure. This is great.
I've got an iPhone app, right? And so I can go here. So hopefully you can see outside where the sink is. And I can just watch this. Boop, hit a button on my phone. And now you can see outside. And then boop, I can hit another button. And now you barely can see anything. There's also window shades that go full blackout. But I just love being able to open this thing up. And it does every single window. It does the door here. It does the whole roof panel up there. You can see I'm hooked up to my Rivian. There's the Model Y that we took on the trip. We're at the farm right now, so you can see that for the ranch channel. And it's just such a amazingly well thought out and designed RV. And in contrast to the Lightship, you couldn't imagine a bigger difference between the two. This one actually works, and the Lightship worked maybe 40% of the time.
It just has a lot smaller battery than and hub motors, which is kind of different approach than the Lightship took as well, right?
Yeah. So the Lightship had like a normal permanent magnet axle half shafts. The half shafts were at like some crazy angle on that thing. This uses a relatively small 45 kilowatt hour BYD blade cell battery. So it can be 100% charged and everything. I think that's too small. I think it should be like 75, 80 minimum, but maybe in the future they'll offer a big battery version. The problem, there's no problem. So it uses hub motors. They're Schaeffler hub motors. We got up under there and pulled the panels off. We had to figure out who made them. So it's different hub motors than what that was on the Lordstown or Lightyear One. It's actually the first time I believe Schaeffler has put this hub motor into production. So we looked up under there, checked it all out. It was pretty cool. They're pretty juicy motors, but the whole thing only ever pushes like 14 or 15 kilowatts, which is not actually enough to offset its drag force on the vehicle. So your towing consumption still goes up. It doesn't go up as much as if you had the system off. And certainly if you had the system dialed all the way up, you could get a lot of force for a very short distance. But it seems to be matched to go with the truck's range at around a combined tow vehicle and tow rig, about 200 miles on a full charge, at least with my Rivian. And 200 miles is okay. But like, for example, I came from the track to here at the farm yesterday where we have charging at both. My truck was actually low on charge. I left at like 65% or something. It's about 70 miles drive. And I pulled in at, I don't know, 15 or 20% on the Rivian. It would have been nice to be able to use all of that 40 kilowatt hours, 45 kilowatt hours in the Pebble. So I hope they give me like an extreme, you know, offset mode and maybe a range mode for its configuration. They said that's going to come through software. The last point I'll make is the bottom 10% of this battery pack is not accessible. In the sense where you can't keep climate on and you can't keep the road mode on. You can only use the bottom 10% for the remote control operation.
Okay. Yeah. So are we going to see this on the, Wes, are we going to see this on the testing channel as well?
Well, we had some, charging stuff going on yesterday.
Okay. So,
yeah, we should have something up.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did a 10 to 100% charging test on this. Took about an hour, peaks at 46 kilowatts, and it pretty much just holds it all the way to 80% and then walks its way down.
I wonder what kind of test you could use to see how it would perform just as like a supplementary room on your house. So, you know, work as backup power or store your solar power to redistribute at night or something like that, if that's even possible, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be open to seeing what kind of tests you would want. I mean, I think that's how I'm using it right now, and it's working. In terms of power consumption, we could look at like a daily power consumption out of this vehicle, like full charge it, run it with HVAC for a day, keep the lights on, maybe cook out of it, and then charge it up the next day and see how many kilowatt hours it takes.
Does it have solar on the roof?
It has 1.1 kilowatts on the roof, yes.
Oh, okay. That's kind of small. But I mean, that's not bad for a roof, though, is it? 1.1 kilowatt.
It's pretty like comparable. It's not a lot, but like, for example, right now, I'm just loading up the app. Solar panels, well, there's a cloud overhead. We're only getting 180 watts right now. But at the beginning of this podcast, we were getting 980 watts of solar.
Oh. That's not bad. That adds up after a while.
There will be some more power stories coming around the Pebble over the next few weeks or months. So I don't know. Maybe they're working on some of this stuff, but I just wish it had a big battery. Like give me this thing with 100 kilowatt hour pack. I'd be so happy.
Right. Yeah. All right. So looking forward to hearing more about that as it tests unfold.
The Batteries Included podcast is sponsored by EVChargingStations.com. If you drive an electric vehicle or you're planning to, this site is packed with comprehensive charger reviews, detailed DC fast charging graphs, and the latest news from all of the fast charging networks. You'll find real-world testing, easy-to-understand comparison, and deep dives into how different electric vehicles actually charge. Before you buy an EV charger, or plan your next road trip, make sure to bookmark evchargingstations.com and make smarter charging decisions.
So, Tom, you have a series of a video series called Recharge Rescue, where you go to people's places and fix their terribly set up EV situations, EV charging situations. I'm trying to pull up this other file, but so people know that already, like in your heart, you're like a good Samaritan. But I understand that now you're even like paying for other people's charging at EVgo. Like, what's up with that?
Yeah. So I think it was on Friday or something last week, I got a notification that, you know, oh, your active charging session on EVgo is, you know, is going on. And I'm like, I'm not charging on EVgo. So I open up the app. I figured the email was, you know, maybe it was a mistake email. So I open up my EVgo app and I see, nope, you have a current session. It shows the pulling like 50 kilowatts or whatever, no, 77 kilowatts at the time. And the vehicle was at 50% state of charge. So, you know, it's not a vehicle that rips. You see it right there, 56%, 77 kilowatt charging at. And although it was a 350 kilowatt station, it was a Pilot Flying J's in Indiana. So I called EVgo and I'm like, could you look this up right now? Because I'm not in Indiana and I'm being billed for somebody's charging session. So they shut the charging session off. At that time, it was like, I don't know, I forget, $17 is the total. And they took all my information. And I just got a call yesterday and they were like, okay, tell us about this. I'm like, okay, I'll tell you about it. I wasn't charging and I was billed for it. And so they asked me about previous vehicles. I've owned other EVs. I don't believe they're linked to the account anymore. I took them off when I sold them. I own two Teslas that I sold. I have a Rivian R1T that I sold a couple of years ago, but I sold it to a friend here in New Jersey and he still lives in New Jersey with it. So he wasn't in Indiana charging. So anyway, they just refunded me my the $17 to my account. But I thought that was crazy that somehow I was being billed for a charging session in Indiana. So, I would just urge people to keep an eye on their account, make sure they're not being billed for something. It went through auto charge. So somehow, I don't know exactly what happened, but the vehicle that plugged in was either cloned one of the vehicles on my account and was billing me, or somehow there was just a communication error and it thought it was one of my vehicles through the auto charge. So, but keep an eye, check your accounts, make sure you're not being billed for a charging session that you didn't do.
Right. That's weird. I've never heard of that before. So, but what we really want to talk about though was, so a year ago, you went down to Texas to charge a Hummer EV at one of three existing Walmart charging network stations. So you made that, and then you just made a trip to Arkansas last week to talk to Adam Happel, who you spoke with the first time as well, I believe, a general manager for retail EV charging at Walmart. So I think your state of charge also is going to have a monthly update on that as well, right?
Yeah, I think the Walmart charging network is an incredibly important network that's coming out. Not that IONNA isn't. IONNA is also, has the opportunity to really change the landscape of EV charging, and they are. They're starting to. But the Walmart, I think, could in some ways even have a bigger impact on the industry if they really were committed to doing this right. That the whole question was, how committed were they? How many store sites were they going to open? How committed were they going to do this? You know, were they going to pull back once, the federal tax credit was ended, and we have an administration now that's kind of doing, I believe, what they can to slow electric vehicle adoption. So was Walmart going to say, well, maybe we ought to punt on this for a little bit and see how the industry goes? So, Adam told me that wasn't going to be the case last year when I spoke with him. He's general manager of Walmart Charging. He comes from Rivian and also EVgo. He's an industry guy. He's been in EV charging for a while. They didn't just bring hire somebody that didn't know what they were doing. And he said all the right things last year, but now they're a year into it. As you mentioned, they had three locations open last year, but those were pilot locations. They weren't like officially open to the public. People could go and use them, but for a while they were even free. They were testing different equipment. They were testing software. They wanted to know what units they were going to use from what manufacturers. They zeroed in on the Alpatronic hyperchargers and also the ABB 400 kilowatt chargers, the AB 400s. So those are the two units that they're going to use in all their locations now. But now it's a year later. They have at this point almost 60 sites open. When I did the video, the interview with him, they had 50 sites open. But they're opening right. sites kind of like IANA now. Every single day, sites are opening, and they have about 400 additional sites currently in permitting and construction. So think about that. In the first year, they really only started about a year ago. They have 50 something sites open, little behind IANA. IANA got about 85 sites open in the first 12 months of installing, and they hit 100 sites in about 13 months. Walmart's going to hit 100 sites, I think, looking at what they're doing there, in about September. So it's going to take them about 16 months, a little bit behind IANA. But I think they have more sites currently in the permitting and construction process. And it's easier for them. They have the real estate already. So, right. you know, they could pull 1,000 permits now if they wanted to, you know, but they're, you know, I think they're trying to figure out where to put them and everything. They're not going to do too many at once. They might not be able to get the hardware that quick to begin with. I don't know if Alpatronic and Walmart could even supply them with the chargers if 2 months from now they wanted to open up 1,000 sites, you know. But in any event, Adam still says all the right things. I talked to him. I learned some new things. One of the biggest problems people had with the Walmart network was that you have to use the Walmart app to initiate a charging session. So a lot of people say, I love what Walmart's doing, but I'm not going to download another app. Okay. In this, in the interview I had with Adam, we learned for the first time that Walmart has listened to people. And they are going to begin to install credit card readers at the sites. They have a credit card reader at one or two pilot sites now just testing it, but they're going to retrofit the chargers and they're going to put credit card readers across the network. So you don't need to use the Walmart app if you don't want to. I mean, if you already are a Walmart customer, if you're a Walmart Plus customer, it makes sense using the app because you get a 10% discount, which adds up, you know, so, some people, depending on, even if you're not I didn't have a Walmart app. I wasn't a Walmart Plus customer, but I have an American Express Platinum card. And one of the perks on that is free Walmart Plus membership. So I just registered my card, downloaded the app, and now I get 10% off using the app when I go to Walmart stations. So that was one of the things I learned. Another thing I had to ask Adam about was, it seemed like they made all of the Walmart chargers have two connectors, a NACS connector and a CCS1 connector. Different than what IANA is doing. IANA is having a 60-40 split on their sites, and 40% are NACS, 60% are CCS. But the whole station, the two connectors are both the same plug. Walmart's not doing that. Every station has one and one. And they put the CCS on the left and the NACS on the right. But that doesn't really make sense for Tesla owners that back into the stall like they're used to. It should be on the left side. And the unfortunate thing is, where I shot this video, it's a pull-through site. So on the pull-through sites, it doesn't matter because you can pull up. So here I am arguing and saying, like, it should be on the other side. And I had a lot of commenters saying, Tom, what do you mean? Just pull up further and you could park in. The problem is not all their sites are pulled through. When it's pulled through, it doesn't matter. I give you that. But anyway, Adam admitted, he said, look, he goes, that's one of the things we missed. So we are beginning now to go out and we're going to pull the cables off. We're going to swap them. We're going to put the NACS connector now on the left side where we should have from the beginning. So that was another thing we learned. And also learned, you know, talking to Adam on camera and off camera, they're dead serious about this. And his basically what he told me was, as big as you might think we're going to go, we're going bigger. So, they have 5,200 locations, Sam's Clubs and Walmarts in the U.S. So,
that's a lot of locations.
Yeah.
A lot of real estate.
If they just did 70% of those locations, I did the math, they'd have as many charging bays as Tesla currently has supercharger bays today in the U.S. And you know how widespread the Tesla supercharger network is. So, and that would be everywhere. At just 70%. Now, I'm not saying that to compare it to the Tesla supercharger network, because Tesla's going to continue to install superchargers. Yeah. They're going to be bigger than Walmart, for sure. But just to give you an idea of the breadth of network, if they just did it 70%, and something tells me that they're going to go higher than 70%. I think 7-8 years from now, Walmart might have 40,000 or 50,000 charging bays, DC fast charge charging bays in the U.S., which, would be amazing. I think Tesla's at like 37,000 now, something in that area. But at the same time, you have to think about this. IONNA said 30,000 charging bays by 2030. So, between IONNA and Walmart, we might have 60,000 additional 400 kilowatt DC fast charging bays in the U.S. compared to just 2025 by 2030, 2031-ish. So, double the amount of charging bays that Tesla has practically now. Additional, while Tesla continues to install more. So basically, the picture I'm trying to paint here, guys, is 5-6 years from now, we are going to look at a completely different landscape than what we see now. I mean, there will be DC fast charging everywhere, high speed, reliable DC fast charging everywhere. Not what we had, 5-6 years ago, with half the stalls were broken and the sites had one charger. We're talking about all the sites with a minimum of 8 to 10 bays, 400 kilowatt, and Tesla's rolling out their V4s now, so that they're all on 1,000-volt architecture. So, I can't express how much of a difference we're going to have in 2030 than what we have now. And what I love about what Walmart's doing, Dom, also is the fact that it's a different use case to me than IONNA. IONNA's going is doing like the enabling long, road trips. They're going right on the highway on these convenience store locations where you pop in, you get a coffee, you charge up for 20 minutes, and then you head down the road. I think Walmart's going to do a better job of serving the locals that don't have home charging, the people that live in apartments and so forth that already shop at Walmart, that live in the area. 90% of Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart. I've said this before. And I think a lot of those people are going to be using the Walmart network. And they're also going to have a feature where they already are rolling it out now, where they deliver your order to your car. You make your order in advance. It gets picked. It's in a bin. You pull up to the Walmart charger. You plug your car in. You get on your app. You say, I'm here in charging bay 6. 2 minutes later, somebody walks out of the store in a cart. And here you go. They put it in your frunk or your trunk for you. You tip the person a couple bucks. And, you don't even have to get out of your car. So there's a lot of things Walmart's going to be able to do. And I know it's not the be-all, end-all. A lot of people have said to me, Tom, I don't want to sit in a Walmart parking lot. That's fine. You don't have to. There's plenty of others. There's superchargers. There's IONNA stations. There's Electrify America. You can go charge wherever you want to. But for a lot of people, I think this is going to be a very important network. And, I'm pleased to say I've spoken with them enough. I'm really the only journalist that they've given access to Adam with to this extent. I'm convinced that they are dead serious, and you're going to see the Walmart charging network is going to be a beast of a network in 5 years from now. And with that, Dom, I only have a minute or two. Is there anything else you wanted from me? I've got to run. I got a meeting.
I think that's about it. Yeah.
All right. Two other things before I take off real quick. So okay. I did a video on the hand show NACS, the CCS1 extension cable, and it failed. It didn't work. If you want to see what happened with that, head over to State of Charge and check it out. They sent me another one now. I'm going to test this one to see how it works. And also, I was in China for a week with Lectron. I have a video coming out probably in about a week. I still have a lot of editing to do. I did a factory tour of Lectron's manufacturing factory in China and got to see, you know, how they make their chargers, their adapters, all that stuff. Interviewed the CEO, Chris Maywald. So that's an interesting video too, if you're interested in manufacturing. We talked a lot about quality control and how they make their products to try to make sure there's no issues and so forth. So with that, I got to run. Wes, okay. Thanks for joining us today. Dom, I'll talk to you next. See you guys next week.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll see you soon. Very soon. All right.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. So, Wes, we just have one more thing to cover really quickly. Yeah. And I'm not sure if you've done any testing with the Volkswagen ID Buzz yet.
Not the Buzz, no, not specifically.
Okay. So a lot of people thought that was over. It was not going to be sold in the U.S. anymore, but that is not the case. What appears to have happened is it just decided to skip the 2026 model year. So it's now announced as 2027 model year. Lineup, and the Buzz is still here. It's going to be here. There's not a whole lot of changes. It's still on CCS charging, although they do say that they're going to have NACS coming soon. And Kyle's back with us.
Sorry, we got a delivery at the farm, and I was trying to message you on everything to tell you I was going to leave.
It's all right. Yeah, Tom just had to go, but we're just going to wrap up. We're just talking about the ID Buzz. It's back for 2027. Didn't really go away, really. We kind of thought it had, but they just didn't have a 2026 model year for it. And so it's back now. Yeah. I'm not sure if that's just like a North America only thing, like a US only thing, or if they have like a 26 model year in Germany. I know it sells better in Europe than it does here. So I think sales have been, I would say, probably disappointing really for them here, right? But it's even the 2027, like I was saying, it's coming with CCS. NACS may be coming soon, but you know, for the beginning at least, it's a CCS one and an adapter basically when you're at a fast charger. There's some new infotainment software, some new trims, and a nostalgic candy white over cherry red color scheme, so I just wanted to let an audience know about that car. Got some severe weather happening outside my window here.
It's interesting. Yeah. They wouldn't take that time to maybe improve and change on some things, because they've if you're going to take that time to not sell the car, you have that opportunity to, because it's one of those things where, okay, maybe it didn't sell well, but as cars get more competitive and we're advancing the EV market really quickly, bringing the ID4 back, ID Buzz back later is just going to make it less competitive if you don't take that time to upgrade something, as they've had some issues with people with the price point and the range not being what a lot of people wanted. That seems pretty odd.
Right.
But hopefully. Yes.
Yeah, that's that car's biggest, the price for the range, but it just needs more range, in my opinion. You know, they said they were going to put a 111 or 117 kilowatt hour battery in it, but that never happened, which I think would have been the right size, but maybe they couldn't get it in there at the price point they were comfortable with. I don't know, but I think they should have tried anyway. Anything else you want to talk about, Kyle? What do you have going on this week?
Scott's over here. You got any EV news for everyone, Scott?
Do I have any EV news?
Yeah.
I'm really hoping to see more R2s on the road.
R2 stuff is happening.
Oh. I think RJ put, or Rivian or RJ, somebody put on social media that the delivery start on the 9th of June. Is that what I saw? I should pull up the exact tweet. Did you retweet that, Kyle?
I did not retweet it.
Okay, I know where I saw it. It was on the Rivian.
Yeah, but R2
it was underneath. Yeah, Rivian tweeted. I just share this whole thing on the screen with you all, actually. That makes sense. Rivian says, June 9 is the big day. R2 officially launches. Order invitations begin. Customer delivery start. Demo drives at all Rivian spaces of the R2. So I think that's something to mark on your calendar. All of them. All the space. I don't know. How many spaces do they have?
It says all of them. But I'm going to start driving by our local space to see if I can spot an R2 getting dropped off. Because, they have to be there before the 9th, I would imagine.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they've been making them for a while now. It's, you know, like at least a couple months, right? They have to have like a ton of them sitting somewhere.
Yeah,
that's exciting. That's like
they pre-built a ton. So I guess maybe there's just going to be a huge, I don't know what their delivery plans are, but there's just going to be a huge swath of them being delivered. We have an early reservation, so I'm hoping we can get one of the first ones. We're ready to go as soon as we can get a launch green one, rock and roll, so that we'll have one. And I think we know what we're going to do with it. My sister actually really wants an R2, but she doesn't want one for another year. She drives a Jeep.
Okay.
Regular. And so I thought maybe we'd get an R2 and eventually it'll switch hands over to her. And then we'll have a great opportunity to do like a super long-term ownership thing over 3 years, 5 years, et cetera.
Right. You're not bothered by not having the second next gen of hardware that's coming in on the fall batches?
Well, that's when we would probably have to get a different one to test that.
Okay. Right. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
But I don't think
that's pretty exciting. That's less than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Less than 2 weeks. It seems like we've been waiting for R2 for like a long, long time. It's been a while, you know, coming, and it's a very exciting vehicle. So, 2 weeks away, you can go to a space and take a test drive. Check it out for yourself. All right. So, yeah, I think that brings us to the end of our show, really. So if you have any questions or comments, please leave them below in our YouTube comment section. Don't forget, if you like the show, please give us a thumbs up. Click subscribe. Tap that bell icon for notifications. Thank you all very much for joining us, and we'll see you again very soon. Ciao.